Charlie, it's the only way. Attaboy. Burp again. Attaboy, come on. Ah, that's wonderful, Charlie. Grab onto me, Charlie. We're gonna be all right now.
That tickles!
Jump.
Good evening, brothers and sisters, and welcome to another edition of Homebrew Talk, your monthly internet radio program that unlocks the mysteries of Zymergy and spreads the homebrew gospel one carboy at a time. Homebrew Talk to you is brought to you by the good folks at Grow Radio, Gainesville's very own community-based, volunteer-driven, non-corporate, non-profit, completely awesome radio station. Check out all the programs at growradio.org. Homebrew Talk is also brought to you by your home... Hometown Hogtown Brewers, a merry band of beer enthusiasts with a home brewing problem. Check out the many things we got going on at hogtownbrewers.org. My name is John. I'm going to be one of your homebrew jockeys tonight. And with me, as always, is my homebrew jockey partner, Ron. Ron and I are both longtime members of the Hogtown Brewers. We are homebrewers for many, many years and BJCP certified homebrew judges. Hello, Ron.
Hello, John.
Ron, you know, after that introduction, I have but one question for you.
Go ahead, shoot.
What the hell did you have for lunch today, man?
I assume you're talking about that little intro we had.
Yeah, that little intro, like from one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, with that intro of Charlie hijacking and getting in trouble with some Willy Wonka fizzy lifting drinks. Mm-hmm. I believe our podcast may have gotten downgraded from our stellar No Fart Jokes AAA rating. I suppose our record is it's no longer pristine.
No, I suppose not. Yeah. I suppose not. Hopefully the blogosphere will be kind.
Yes. But yes, we are gassy tonight, and by that I mean nitrogen gas. Mm. We'll walk through how to use it, how to carbonate with it, and why it's so great. It's great, right?
It is great.
It is.
Tiny bubbles.
And, you know, we are also, you know, along with all that, we're going to do a terrific Guinness clone recipe to give you something to use the nitrogen on.
There you go.
Yeah. Plus, we'll have fun with sour beers, mm-hmm. if that's your thing, which for many people it is.
Yep.
But right now, let's make bubbles. I mentioned nitrogen was great, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, why do you think that nitrogen's great? Give me a couple of reasons.
Nitro gives that smooth, silky mouthfeel. It costs a lot. It's a good way to drain your homebrew dollar
budget.
Homebrew
dollars, yes.
Yes.
Well, I definitely agree with you on the smooth texture, you know, and that creamy, stable foam mm-hmm. that it imparts on your beer. And it does, in addition, different from CO2, it does alter the character of the beer, what it does to the malt perception, and definitely will round out hop bitterness for those beers that have a hop kick to it. And of course, hey, visibly, that nitrogen surge upon pouring, you can't beat that.
No, that's gold.
It's gold, Jerry. You know, there are certain styles that go quite well with being put on nitro. Mm-hmm. You obviously can pick the first couple, you know, beers that have roast or black malt character, such as stouts and porters and even browns, you know, and that goes from dry stout all the way to imperial stout, you know, even, you know, the lightweight to the heavyweights. Nitrogen will round hop bitterness, so it's maybe just my opinion, but I definitely think that English pale ales absolutely taste great on nitro, as from ordinary bitters all the way to best bitters. And well, I'm not sure if I've ever had an ESB on nitro, but it probably would work too. But anyone who's had a Boddington's in a pub, which is usually on nitro, just like Guinness is, You would know what I mean.
Oh, yeah. That's the goods.
But not just English. I personally also think American pale ales work well, too, on nitro. Mm-hmm. And, of course, lots of small beers tend to work.
Mm-hmm. Something seen more and more, I think, with American craft brewers. I know New South there in Myrtle Beach has, I believe it's one of their pale ales is on nitro. Very interesting stuff.
Yep. I mean, when I walk in the bar and I see they have one or two or three things on nitro, those typically will be on my radar for coming across that for the evening.
Oh, yeah.
There are some styles that may not go as well. Now, this is just obviously total opinion, but I should think that beers known for their effervescence, like certain Belgian beers and Hefes, probably don't go well with nitro because, well, you're kind of taking away their character.
Sure.
Some, a lot of sweet beers, I don't, you know, that aren't roasty, aren't hoppy, like, you know, barley wine. Well, barley wine can be hoppy, but, you know, sweet beers, especially strong sweet beers like barley wine and Doppelbock, probably iffy if they go well on nitro. However, hey, you're a home brewer. Do what you want.
That's right.
Try it. And although we're later going to have fun with sours, I'm not so sure sours would go well on nitro.
No.
So
no.
We, what an excellent pairing we had for tonight's topics, huh?
The effervescence of a Berliner Weiss would be just shot down to pieces.
Yes, quite. Now, some characteristics of nitrogen, of what it imparts to your brew. Note, and bear with me if some of this is basic to you, but we're going to go through it, make sure we're all on the same page. Nitrogen, not very soluble like CO2 is. You basically have to have quite a bit of pressure to make it soluble. When that pressure is gone, it comes right out of solution. It tends to have fine bubbles, especially when you have the right tools for carbonating and pouring. And, of course, we all know that stable, creamy foam that occurs, especially like you've seen on a Guinness or dry stout. And a lot of that is due to, well, it's nitrogen. And the atmosphere around it, the air, is about 78% nitrogen. It tends, so you have stability there. Nitrogen inside the foam and outside, it tends to be a more stable foam than a CO2 head.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Nitrogen does not compress like CO2 does. And that's why you may notice, well, when you get a tank of nitrogen, it's a big tank. Unlike CO2 tanks, which can be smaller because they can be compressed better, so they can go into a smaller space. You could do, for example, a 5-pound tank of nitrogen or beer gas, if you're going to correct me later. you know, you won't get the same amount compared to CO2.
Sure.
So that's why you got the big tanks. Now, if you're thinking, well, this sounds good. I've had beers on nitro. I'm a home brewer. Got some good beers that I think would work on nitro. Well, I'm in for it. What do I got to get? Also, how much? All right, strap in there. Equipment needed on the homebrew level to serve your beers on nitro. I kind of tell people, well, if you're going to do it, you're in for a penny, in for a pound, because you can't just get one or two pieces of it. You got to get the whole circuit, the whole thing, start to finish. There is a couple things that are optional, but here's what you definitely need. You need to get a beer gas tank. Okay, now notice I said beer gas tank instead of a nitrogen tank. Your beer gas tank is going to be 75% nitrogen, 25% CO2. And that's because even though you're pouring, and you're going to get that nice nitrogen surge and that nice creamy foam, your beer still... it needs some low level of carbonation. Nitrogen beers do not tend to be highly carbonated, but they do tend to have some low level carbonation. That carbonation does come from CO2. If you had nothing but nitrogen and no CO2, it would be rather on the flat side. So you will want to get a beer gas tank. Beer gas tank you could get from your local
gas provider.
Gas dealership, like in Gainesville, Praxair, or I don't know, that's where I got it, but or any chain like that. The cost for the tank, and this was, I got a 20-pound tank, I think, and that cost over $200.
Yo!
Yeah, and it would have cost me a lot more if I asked for aluminum. I got lucky, though. I said, well, no, just give me the heavy metal one. And I'm not, because I'm probably going to be trading this tank out when it gets empty anyways.
Was that the one with the Metallica sticker on it?
Beavis and Butthead in their t-shirts, yeah. Yes. And AC/DC.
Yes.
But I got lucky. The guy gave me an aluminum one anyways. So,
score! So hopefully Praxair is not listening tonight.
Well, they can't have it back. And then there, to actually fill up the tank, it wasn't that much. I thought it was like $35 or something like that. Of course, you could get the one that's like 6 foot tall for your home. You could do that, and a lot of gas places tend to have that. I thought the 20-pound one that I have, it was a little hard to get my hands on. Now, you also need a special regulator on it, a nitrogen regulator. You can't use the CO2 regulator. First of all, it probably won't fit right on the tank anyways. Nitrogen regulator, they run about $80. I got mine from Micromatic because they tend to have some good quality regulators.
Now, I guess they need to be able to handle that higher pressure.
Yes, although, I mean, CO2 regulators can go up to 30 PSI, no problem.
True.
These will handle it. Gas tubes, corny kegs, gas disconnects that you use normally for CO2, you can continue to use that. That part doesn't change. Then comes the fun part. Go get yourself a special tap, a.k.a. the Guinness tap, which has a diffuser and spout. Now, the diffuser, that's where a lot of the magic happens. That's where it's got these five small holes. Is there a hose in there? Five small holes. As the beer goes through it, those five small holes, that's my tongue twister, causes the nitrogen and some of the CO2 to come out of solution, creating that nice nitrogen surge you see being poured and dazzling you as you're pouring your glass.
Yeah.
And, that's... Now, the tap, the Guinness tap that you'd buy that has a diffuser and the spout, it connects to your kegerator shank just as a normal everyday tap that you have. So there's nothing special there. You don't need a special shank or anything. Just get the Guinness tap. That cost, I think that cost me about $90 to go get. Now, if you add all these numbers together, that's over $400.
Yeah.
Tax and all. I waited a long time to do it, and I've always wanted to. Finally, I just, I worked hard.
Yeah.
It's a hobby.
Sure,
Why not?
All the royalties we get from Homebrew Talk, walking around money.
Yes. Also, I bought it after I told my wife.
Important safety tip, brothers and sisters.
All right. So now you got your tank. You got all the other equipment. Now, and you brewed a great beer that's worthy of being put on nitro, whatever style that may be. Now it's time to carbonate that beer. Do you carbonate it the same way as CO2? Of course not. It's got to be a little different. After you keg your beer as normal, that doesn't need to change. Then you can do it one or two ways. The first way, I'm going to give you the more ideal way, which I really think you should strive for because I think it's worth it. Even though you might have to throw in another $50 to do it this way. All right. The ideal way is to get a carbonation stone. And if you want to get a really ideal carbonation stone, this is just my opinion, you may want to opt to buy the carbonation stone and corny keg lid that you can get at morebeer.com. Costs a little over $50. Why that? You could get a carbonation stone and not have to put in the money for that lid. But if you do that, you have to get the right tubing, not a big deal, but you have to connect that tubing on the inside of your corny keg to the gas inlet tube, and don't forget the clamp or else it'll blow off when you put 30 PSI through it. And, of course, clamp it at the stone also. That's a mild ass pain, in my opinion. The more beer corny keg lid, you simply put it on like any other lid. It's got a nice tube that doesn't float. It's stiff tube.
So it's hard piped, so to speak.
Sure. So it causes the the carbonation stone to be near the bottom, which is what you want, obviously. And it's got a gas inlet on on that lid and a gas release valve too. So you all you simply have to do is put set your regulator to 30 PSI, connect it to the lid, flush the headspace a few times with the gas release valve because you want to get rid of whatever air or oxygen you happen to let in during the act of putting the thing on. And as mentioned, set the regulator to 30 PSI. You're going to hear a lot of bubbling for a minute or two or three. And you can simply sit, let it sit there for 3 days. After 3 days, and you start pouring your beer, especially a low gravity beer, you'll definitely begin to get the nitrogen surge upon pouring. And that certainly is a visual indication that your beer is just about properly carbonated. Now, it will continue, the maturity of the carbonation will continue even on days after that. But if you can wait 3 days, that's the easy way to do it. You just almost do a Ronco, set it and forget it kind of thing. Okay. Now, you can help speed it up if you're in a hurry for some reason by slowly bleeding with the gas release valve as often as you can. You know, every time you walk by your keg, you know, just a slow release, hold it there for as many minutes as you can and just let it bubble through, and that'll help speed it up. If you ever read a BYO Wizard article on it from years ago, the Wizard indicated how they did that commercially. They had a real big batch of it, and they bled beer gas through it for 30 minutes, rested for 30 minutes, and then bled it again for 30 minutes. Then he indicated, well, how would you do this for homebrewing? Well, he indicated he would do it the same way. 30 minutes, rest 30, then bleed it for another 30. I don't really care to stand there for 30 minutes, nor do I really have the means to gingerly set my gas release to slowly bleed for 30 minutes. So I opted for the experiment, just sit it there. I usually just sit it there for my normal beers anyways with CO2 for 3 days. I can wait 3 days.
And I guess if you adopt the Wizard's technique, it's helpful to have an uncle in the gas business too.
Yeah, it is. Does seem a little inefficient.
Yeah. Yeah.
But hey, if you got gas, and that intro indicated we did.
If you got to go, you got to go.
Yeah. The other way you could do it, I'm not fond of this way, but I'm going to mention it. You can carbonate your beer with CO2 first. Now, I don't think that's going to be a reliable way to do it because you could have too much CO2 if you don't do it right. And the effect of that is when you pour through your special Guinness tap, you're going to get foam, lots of foam. Now, the beer will still be good and creamy and all that, but you're not going to get a nitrogen surge. It's just going to be foam until it settles. Even though, you know, after you carbonate with CO2 and push it with nitrogen or beer gas at 30 PSI as normal, you know, that's the problem. So you feel free to try either way, whatever your preference. My preference is carbonation stone, beer gas, sit there for 3 days. And, well, yeah, if I'm in a hurry, maybe I'll bleed it a little bit. I tried both ways. I just didn't think the extra effort of bleeding was worth it when it could be ready in 3 days. Right?
Right.
Okay. Now, one question is, you know, hey, is it possible for homebrewers to have to do a proper nitrogen beer in a bottle? Well, currently, I don't think so. We currently don't have any homebrewing tools for doing that. And in fact, back in early or mid 2000s, that was a question to the BYO Wizard, and that he also confirmed, no, homebrewing wise, we do not have those tools yet. But, you know,
14 years later, no progress on that front.
No progress on that front. We can man on the moon and all that, but we can't put nitrogen in a bottle for the home brewer. But I'll tell you what, later in the show, we will go over a terrific Guinness clone recipe. But up next, we're going to have fun with sour beers. And right now, let's take some time for some gassy tunes.
Sounds
listening
so
to
invited.
Homebrew Talk on Grow Radio.
Tiny bubbles. Make me happy, make me feel fine.
Tonight in a bar, alone I'm sitting. Apart from the laughter and cheers, while scenes from the past rise before me. Just watching the bubbles in my beer, a vision of someone who loved me brings a long silent tear to my eye. Oh, I know that my life has been a failure, just watching the bubbles in my beer. Seeing the road that I've traveled, a road paved with heartaches and tears, and I'm seeing the past that I've wasted while watching the bubbles in my beard. As I think of the heart that I've broken and the chances I know have passed me by, and the dreams that I've made now are empty as the bubbles in my beer.
Homebrew Talk.
Oh,
All right, welcome back to Homebrew Talk. And, you know, I was at a Rush concert.
Yeah, can't and, imagine.
And
was I with you?
You were not. You were not, actually.
Okay.
And in the middle of the show, after a song, Geddy Lee comes out with a acoustic guitar, sits down, starts strumming a very blatant country-type tune.
No way.
And we're all in our heads going, what the hell? and then he abruptly stops and goes, yeah, I know how Rush fans just love country music. And then proceeded to a real Rush song. But I would say that might be our first true country song on Homebrew Talk.
Well,
what's up with that?
That could be, but if you played close attention to the chorus there, that was Bubbles in My Beer by George Jones.
Yes.
Who at one point lived in my hometown of Lakeland.
Ah,
little trivia there for you. And then, of course, I know there's folks out there that can't tolerate the country. So for those of you rockers, you cannot deny being followed up by a little cover there of Jumpin' Jack Flash by Motorhead.
We had to give them the antidote.
Right, right. and why Jumpin' Jack Flash, you may ask?
I ask.
Because it's a gas, gas, gas.
Aha.
Whoa, Nelly!
Okay, moving very quickly from nitrogen in your beer to some funk in your beer. We're going to talk a little bit about sour beer brewing today. You know, sour beers gaining more popularity. You're seeing more commercial varieties of them. You're seeing them showing up in craft beer bars, which is really cool. And naturally, there's a lot of interest generated by homebrewers. And reflective of that is the new BJCP categories that are just about to come out. I understand that there is an American Wild Ale category in there with subcategories of Brett Beer, Mixed Fermentation Sour, and Sour Fruit Beer.
Yep, and God help you for those taking the written test.
Holy smokes. Yes, I'm glad I slid under and got my certification when I did, because there's quite a few new styles and quite a few new specialty categories. But as our friend Alton Brown would say, that's a whole nother show.
Yes.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about traditional sour beer styles, the ingredients that go into sour beers, and talk mainly about fermentation and some fun fermentation techniques that you and your home brewing friends can share in. So traditional sour beer styles, it's this show's being recorded in June. It's starting to get quite hot and humid down here in Florida. Berliner Weiss is a great summer drinker, really sour, crisp, tart, refreshing. That is the Berliner Weiss, of course, is essentially a wheat beer. Lactobacillus is the organism that makes the beer sour, and lactobacillus, as you would imagine, makes lactic acid, which is tart and lends that crisp quality to the beer. Also, in traditional styles, we have Flanders Red and Flanders Brown. These are Belgian beers that are indeed fermented with Brettanomyces, which is a yeast and not a bacteria, and they have more of an acetic acid quality to them, so it's more of a vinegar-like sour as opposed to the lactic tartness. And then probably the most complex of them all and probably most well-known is the lambics, and these are traditionally done with a combination of wild yeast and bacteria. And that is a great beer that that involves terroir. Is that how you pronounce it? The concept of land and place. Ron is obviously my French pronunciation is way off, but looks like terrier, but terroir, I believe, is how you say it. And that refers to the classic lambic breweries in Belgium, where it's not only the air and the wild yeast, but it's actually the buildings. The beers are often produced and cooled in these large vessels called cool ships, up in the attics of these buildings that are, you know, decades, sometimes centuries old, and they got all kinds of stuff going on up there. So it's really to get that genuine lambic, that sense of place is absolutely essential. But homebrewers, being the innovative and creative folk that they are, all kinds of new beers out there. There's in the latest issue of BYO, there's a recipe for an all bread IPA. Had a great old ale at the Hogtown Brew Off. that had secondary fermentation with Brett. Fantastic beer. So there's lots of different ways that you can introduce these funky yeasts and or bacteria into all kinds of beer styles and see what you can come up with. So talking a little bit about what goes into sour beers, often pale malts, Pilsner as base malt, often very common, sometimes Munich or Vienna malts are involved.
Vanilla Vienna. That's a great.
Yeah, sure. Why not? Might be a new thing to try. But these plain base malts often open the door to great experimentation with fruits, herbs, spices, syrups, all kinds of stuff. As mentioned before, the Berliner Weiss is essentially a wheat beer, up to 50%. Wheat is used in the grist of those beers. And sour beers tend to mash at higher temperatures, so usually 154 to 155 allows some residual sugars to be left over for secondary fermentation. And often you'll include some unmalted wheat as a small 5 to 10% or 5 or so percent of the grist bill can be used as the bacteria like those starches over the course of the long souring process. As far as hops are concerned, you definitely want to be using low alpha hops. Generally speaking, hop bitterness and sourness generally don't go together, although there are some exceptions to that. East Kent Goldings and Willamette are good examples of hops to use for sour beers. IBUs usually in the single digits for these beers, generally no more than 10 or 12 IBUs at the most. And often aged hops are used in these beers. And one of the reasons for that is the high alpha levels can have an antibacterial quality that may inhibit the development of the sour character. So these beers can be a great use of those hops that haven't been sealed quite properly and may have been sitting around your freezer for quite some time. Fermentation, that's really the secret to great sour beers. You need lots of time and patience for these beers. Some of them can certainly go up to a year. The beer is often inoculated with bacteria or wild yeast after primary fermentation, and that's often done by racking the beer into a secondary fermenter. It takes a long time to ferment these beers because certain bacteria lie dormant until a particular condition is reached, and that can be triggered by temperature, it can be triggered by pH. Long-time listeners of the show might remember last October, Master Dr. Irish George reported that he would brew sours, particularly Berliner Weisses, in the summer and leave the carboy in his garage, where it often got up to 90 degrees. Now, he was souring with lactobacillus, and the lacto bacteria like those high temperatures. So that is one way, if you are in a hurry and want to get one going quickly, that you can aid along the development of that sour character. Another one of our Hogtown members, soon to be Dr. Jack, also a Hogtown member and friend of the show, told me he actually wrapped his carboy in an electric blanket, placed it in a cooler, had it at up in the high 90s, up to 100 degrees. But you do have to be careful if you try to speed up the process. It does have its costs. It can result in a harsh and unpleasant sourness. So if you do have the need for speed, I'd recommend more frequent sampling to determine the appropriate level of sourness. However, if you have the space and time, the best approach, in my opinion, is patience. Brett will do its job at a stable temperature. It will just take longer to do it. Now, another important difference in making sour beers is the addition of oxygen. Now, usually as homebrewers, we're taught to keep oxygen away from our wort during fermentation. Of course, we're going to aerate it before we pitch the yeast, but other than that, we want to keep oxygen away. But this isn't the case with sours, and especially those that are soured via bacteria instead of yeast. Small amounts of oxygen are important to let those bugs work their magic. And this can be done by aging in a wood vessel or a barrel. That's a popular and effective technique. If you don't have a barrel, one option is to use wood cubes or spirals in the secondary fermenter. Now, this will mimic some of the flavors imparted by wood-aged beers, but it won't help with adding oxygen. One option is you could use a wood stopper in your carboy, and this could be a dowel that would fit and give you a good seal on the carboy. And what this does, it allows a little bit of oxygen to let the critters in to do their work. It gives them that little bit of oxygen. While the secondary fermentation is going on, it's common for a pellicle to form on top of the fermenting beer. And this is a layer of mucus-like material, which probably won't get you too excited to drink it, but it's not a problem. It is actually usually a good sign that the fermentation is continuing to take place. If you're using Brettanomyces to ferment your beer in the secondary fermenter.
Yeah, looks like someone sneezed in your beer.
However, if the pellicle does not form, if your sneeze guard was effective, that's not necessarily a bad thing. And you can taste the beer, I'd say, every 3 to 4 months to check its progress. So you do have to have a lot of patience, you know, with these beers. But hey, you know, if you got empty carboys sitting around, why not? Give it a shot. Tie it up with a sour beer. one thing I did want to talk about is the Solera technique. And this is done in a barrel or a series of barrels in which a certain percentage of beer is drawn out of the barrel and then replaced with fresh wort.
Yeah, it's a barrel of fun.
It's a barrel of fun that you can roll out with you and your friends. And actually, this most recent, the 2014 May-June issue of BYO has a great article if you're interested. If you just simply Google Solera beer barrel, you'll find a lot of information on this. Barrels can be expensive, anywhere from $100 to over $200. But hey, you know, if you have a nitro setup, you know, a barrel, there's nothing to it.
Also, don't tell your wife you bought a barrel.
But since it is expensive, this is really kind of a cool thing to go in with a home brewing partner, perhaps
talk your club and doing it.
Or talk your club into doing it. We're trying to get that rolling here with the Hogtown Brewers. I understand that our brothers and sisters over in Jacksonville, the Cask, Calvert Ale Sharing Club, is doing this, which I think is really cool. The example that was cited in BYO this month had a couple of brewers that inoculated a 50-gallon barrel with a strain of East Coast yeast. Now, once a year, 20 gallons are pulled from the barrel and then replaced with 20 to 25 gallons of fresh wort. Now, the reason why more wort is added than is drawn out is because you have to account for some evaporation. So those of you who are distillers out there, you know, that would be known as the angel's share. So they take that 20 gallons out, and they split 10 gallons each, bottle 5 gallons straight out of the barrel, and then experiment with the additional 5 gallons by adding fruit, spices, dry hopping, or even blending the beer. So lots of cool things that you can do with the Solera method. It can be an aid to consistency in that you're having the same microorganisms at work at your beer, or you can get adventurous and add a whole new style of beer after a future pool. So an example was given in there using a Solera with different variations of Saison recipes. So the Solera project can really go on for quite some time, but as we know, all good things must come to an end. And so you can get some of those autolytic autolysis sorts of flavors. When the beer stops tasting good, you know, might be time to drain the barrel and give it a good cleaning.
Did you get a sense of how long a project can go on?
You know, according to the article, they implied that it could go on for years.
Seems like it.
Yeah. So, you know, it's really kind of an interesting thought. You know, eventually, and they did some calculations of how long, you know, naturally you're diluting isn't the right word. But after a while you have very little of your original, you know, beer in there. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a really interesting concept and, one that could be absolutely fantastic, for a homebrew club. Last thing I wanted to mention with, brewing sour beers is a topic of sanitation. You know, lots of information, lots of threads out there on homebrew forums about this. Generally, the recommendation is anything that's plastic or vinyl, your wine thief, racking cane, if you have a plastic racking cane, it's a good idea to have a completely separate set for sour and non-sour beers. Good news is the plastic and vinyl parts are generally not too expensive, so it's not completely cost prohibitive to have a completely separate set for your sours. But as far as fermenters are concerned, if you're fermenting in a glass carboy in a keg, just a good thorough cleaning with 140 degree PBW, letting it sit overnight, good rinse, thorough rinse with star sand after that. Generally not an issue. So, you do have to be very, very careful, of course. And, you know, if you have multiple fermenters around, you know, why not dedicate one to sours? That certainly won't hurt as well. But, you can't count on if you do a sour and then you're going to just pitch, do a normal beer with regular brewer's yeast, in there. You can't count on the brewer's yeast to fight off the bugs, because the brewer's yeast will conk out. There could be some. There will likely be some residual sugars, and that's when the funky bugs will wake up and do their thing, and thus create an infection.
So that would just be folly to do that.
That would be folly. So. So sanitation, as always, is important with any home brewing project, but in particular with sour beers. So I think I've come to the sour conclusion that this segment is at an end. So we are going to listen to a BrewTune break. You're listening to Homebrew Talk on Grow Radio.
Such a man. I'd follow him to hell and back, I would.
Bye.
Homebrew Talk.
All right, welcome back to Homebrew Talk, and hey, that was a sweet tune break with some sour songs.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm just blissed out here. That was a very kind of refreshingly sour tune break. We had a little Portishead in there doing Sour Times, and that was followed up by the Stone Temple Pilots doing Sour Girl.
General, in all my years of covering top secret discoveries with sheets, I've never dramatically revealed anything as shocking as this. Dun, dun, dun.
Son, I think I can safely say,
brilliant! And by that, I'm going to reveal a terrific Guinness clone recipe.
Whoa.
Yes, deep.
Watch out, St. James's Gate.
Yep. Now, and this recipe, I brewed it three times. One, the very first time, it was a group brew with my former group, Fort Lauderdale Area Brewers, known as FLAB. Shout out to you dudes. And we did the extract with the partial grain version, put it on nitro, and we did a side-by-side with Guinness, and it totally, totally worked.
Very favorable.
Oh, nice. Yeah. It competed very well with Guinness and, in my opinion, exceeded. And then I brewed it on my own, but using CO2, and then very recently did it again because I'm very fond of it and put it on nitro because, hey,
dun,
thought
dun,
I got nitro.
Dun.
And once again, did a side-by-side, very happy with it. So this is a very consistent, very tasty recipe. I'm going to tell you, it's 5 gallons, and it is indeed inspired by a BYO recipe back in May of June of 2005. Now, surprisingly, BYO put out a recipe compilation, whether it was their 100 or 250 recipe, whatever. And they did have another Guinness clone recipe in it, but it wasn't this one. It was a totally different one, surprising. And the one that I'm about to tell you will tell you how to put the Guinness tang into it. Ever heard of that one?
The Guinness tang.
The Guinness tang.
That was the Guinness that the astronauts took to the moon?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Or Guinness is rumored, right, to have sour beer as one of its ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
So this BYO recipe in 2005 tells you how to mimic that. The one in their later compilation said nothing about it.
Oh, interesting.
No. Jeez. However, if you do go to BYO.com, you can search for it. It still is online. I did confirm that prior to coming online and
collaboration. Our crack research staff confirmed that for us. That's great.
No stone unturned. So let's go brew. Ingredients are simple. Technique is simple. 5 gallon batch. You're going to get 5 pounds of British pale malt. And basically Maris Otter, if you can. 2.5 pounds flaked barley. 1 pound roasted barley. Of course, that's unmalted. So it's just 3 grains. That's it. Very simple. And English hops. Any English hops, really. It's just for bittering. East Kent Coldings will be your likely choice. You're going to put 44 IBUs of bittering into this. So I can't tell you how many ounces of hops. Obviously, that differs according to how many alpha acids your particular variety you get. But just work it out with your brew software. You do have brew software, right? Good.
Oh, yeah. They listen to Homebrew Talk.
Yeah, you know, that, to work it out.
That's going to be a pretty big dose of EKG, though, right? I mean, that's generally low alpha hop.
Yeah, that's usually about, I don't know, 5% alpha acids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
It might be a couple ounces, I guess. And you're going to use Irish yeast. I'm a fan of WLP004. That works just fine. You're going to mash at 150. Everything I've said so far, pretty standard, right? 3 grains, mash at 150. 1 dose of bittering hops at 60 minutes with some English hops. And there you go. Oh, yeah. Let's put that Guinness tang in there. They call it the Wang Bang tang, by the way.
Was Ted Nugent co-brewing on this one or something? Or?
No guns were involved in this.
All right, good. Or bows and arrows.
So here's the deal. After you pitch the yeast in your carboy, you will siphon out 19 ounces of wort. That's just a little over half a liter into a sanitized flask. Then, in that flask, you're going to pitch some Brettanomyces and lactobacillus into it. Well, how do you do that? Well, the easy way is just get yourself a vial of White Labs WLP-655. That is a blend of Brett and Lacto. That'll do it. Just no starter needed. Just throw the vial in. Then cover that flask with aluminum foil and go ahead and ferment. Probably at the same temperature as your carboy. Then when done fermenting, well, how long does that take? Well, it's not going to take that long. Probably will be done in a day, but I give it several days just for the hell of it. I'm not in a hurry. Then pour that sour beer into a saucepan and heat it to 160 degrees for 15 minutes. Obviously, you're pasteurizing is what we're doing here. Then cool it down and pour it back into the flask and refrigerate. And you're good with that. It's pasteurized, sour beer, ready to go. Then when your dry stout is ready to keg, we'll go keg it. And then grab that flask and pour it in very gently. Don't need oxygen. And with a sanitized paddle, do a very gentle stir. And go keg. And you know what I would do next? I'd put it on nitro.
Brilliant!
Got that right. So I wonder what's brewing.
So has your homebrew rig upgraded to using pumps? You like the throttle control one gets with the ball valve, but cringe when you think about cleaning it? This is What's Brewing. You know, we're sparing no expense here on Homebrew Talk tonight. We're talking about upgrading to going to nitro. You know, we're going to spend some money. I'll continue on that trend. I just wanted to talk about the Quick Clean ball valve that I recently discovered, and it makes brew day cleanup no problem at all. This certainly helps if you have the tri-clover ferrules on your homebrew rig, which I know that can be an expensive upgrade. But the 1-inch tri-clover compatible Quick Clean ball valve goes for about $40 on Brewer's Hardware, and the big difference is that the valve is clamped together with a tri-clamp rather than being threaded together. So cleaning is really, really easy. A thorough flushing with PBW and then taking the valve apart to rinse with water does the job beautifully. I have one on the wort side of my plate chiller so I can control the rate at which the wort passes through the chiller. And then also on the wort out so I can have better control of my lautering rate. It works great. It saves time and hopefully will decrease the chance of contamination because I certainly have used many threaded ball valves in my time, and if you don't clean those out on a semi-regular basis, you can actually go and check some of our old episodes of Homebrew Talk on some details about that. But ball valves get nasty, and but if you want to control the flow rate, I mean, there's just no better, at least in my opinion, substitute than ball valves. Butterfly valves, of course, very, very excellent, you know, in terms of keeping clean, but they're not quite just an on-off sort of a valve, but they just don't do the job that ball valves do with restricting that flow. And so if you have the opportunity to upgrade to that Quick Clean ball valve, man, that's gold, Jerry. So we're reaching the end here. We always, as we say on Homebrew Talk, support your local breweries and craft beer bars. Give us a like on Facebook and or follow us on Twitter at Homebrew Jockey.
Boy, I'm sure glad that's over with. Me too! Yeah, but you know, I learned something today.
Yeah, I mean, the lesson's clear. If you have to be gassy, you do it with nitro.
Yeah, and I learned, you know, to expand your homebrewing repertoire, be like Lou Reed. Take a walk on the wild side.
Ah. All right, we're out of gas here at Homebrew Talk. We'll be back next month. But if you can't wait, you can always check out our past podcasts at homebrewjockey.com.
You stole fizzy lifting drinks. You bumped into the ceiling, which now has to be washed and sterilized, so you get nothing. You lose. Good day, sir.